Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey friends, welcome to Shift Drink on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C.
Actually, today we're going to pronounce it Leon.
The Leon Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I am Eddie Ken, un garçon mignon et fier d'ici-est.
Wow, dude, just stop showing off.
Hey, I can pull it off.
I can't, so I'm jealous. But I'm Matthew Ramsey, Wile E. Coyote, burger wrangler, and ice cream therapist. Every week we share a shift drink and swap war stories from behind the line with chefs, bartenders, bakers, brewers, and anyone who touches this all-encompassing industry. This week... we have quite the guest. We are joined by a French chef and restaurateur, Daniel Boulud, proud owner of 3 Michelin stars, 13 restaurants, 10 books, and he's full of character.
Hello, trouble boys.
Welcome, welcome. Now, it's not our usual shift drink time. It's earlier, but we are still drinking.
We're still drinking.
Yeah.
It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We actually just started off with a round of espresso shots because Daniel, you were up very early this morning.
Yes.
On the TV, wowing the viewers.
Yes, so that was our first shot of espresso.
So espresso, and then now we're drinking a Negroni.
So to everyone, good morning.
Yeah.
And now we're drinking a Negroni. I can tell.
Well, so we were told your shift drink, we were given 3 options. It was you like to have champagne with lunch, and then a Negroni, and then red burgundy for dinner.
Oh, yes. Well, right. But Negroni come after the red burgundy.
Oh, it comes after the...
We're jumping ahead here.
That's your... I think that's your bartender sort of DNA with us.
Yeah.
Right.
Negroni come
Negroni's
first.
An aperitif, folks. Negroni's an aperitif.
Yeah, usually for breakfast. Yeah.
So we chose a Negroni because this particular Negroni is made with all local or sort of local products. Capitoline Vermouth and Capitoline Tiber. Mm-hmm. Locally made Vermouth.
Delicious.
And Campari. And then I actually threw some Japanese gin in here.
Nice.
You said locally made Campari?
Yeah, it was similar to Campari. It's a, mm-hmm. In an Italian bitter liqueur style. It's red with cochineal coloring. So that's made by one of our good friends and former guest, Kat Amidi.
Kat Amidi, okay, cool.
Yeah. We'll get you a bottle. So you can take home with you.
I may have some at DBGB.
That's right.
I have two.
That's right.
As the bartender, yeah.
But now... I mean, has the Negroni always been your kind of classic go-to? Or is this...
I like bitter. So, yeah. You know, anything with Suze, with Campari, Suze.
Oh, he's saying Suze. He's still my heart. My French heart.
And many other bitters with Cynar or... my bartender at Daniel or at Café Boulud. We both have a bar there. Daniel has a special bar program there. And Café Boulud also. We have Bar Pléiade, the bar at Daniel. And both bartenders, they're exceptional and very creative. And they know that I always like bitter. So they do wonderful other things, but they always do one special for me.
So you came to D.C. in 1981.
Mm-hmm. 1980.
And... when you started working in kitchens here, I'm going to assume that Suze was not available here in the States because that's a specialty product.
Yeah, but because you're in D.C. and there's the diplomatic suitcase, in every corner of D.C., someone is smuggling something from their own country. So Suze was available.
You were able to drink very well for your shift drink back in the 80s.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I've not been. I mean, I don't want anybody to think that I'm drinking every day of the job. But arriving in D.C., I worked in the diplomatic circle of as a private chef to an embassy, the European Economic Community. And so I was surrounded by French and European, Italians and Spanish. And I met many people, many American, French chef in the restaurant business, but I was not in the restaurant business. But I had friends such as Jean-Louis Paladin, who was in the restaurant business. There were Yannick Cam, who had the restaurant Le Pavillon at the time. There was restaurant Jean-Louis. And then there was the old guard of the French, like Jean-Pierre and other, Dominique. So anyway, the Suze was easy to have because I guess those diplomats were just bringing container every week of whatever they were missing, you know, cheese and booze.
Before there are tariffs and embargoes.
Yeah,
going on.
Exactly. And before they put a little damp on that.
I mean, how does a farm boy from Lyon end up in D.C.? Was this your first culinary endeavor? Or?
No. I had the chance to learn from some of the finest master in France. I was 25 years old or 24 years old when I was asked to come to DC, and I was already a chef because I started at 14, so I had 10 years of experience.
So not even close.
and I felt that was a great opportunity to discover America. I had a lot of friends who had worked here in New York City mostly. I didn't have any friends in D.C., but I made friends the first day with some colleagues I knew and I had to go and see. Some colleagues told me, oh, you got to go and see this one and this one. So they were Francis Lerle, who many of the chef community knows him, Francis. And Francis Lerle was the chef at the French Embassy, and he was living right across the street from where I was working on Belmont Road in Massachusetts, right near the behind the mosque.
Yeah.
On Belmont Road, en masse. And so I made friends with Francis. Then I went to see the team at Jean-Louis, the restaurant Jean-Louis at the Watergate. The first day I arrived, I barely dropped my suitcase. I said, I need to go to Jean-Louis and figure it out who is here in this town. And made friends with them there right away. And so it was the beginning. And Jean-Louis, 2 years later, when I wanted to come to New York to work in New York, the Watergate was managed by a management company, Forte Hotel, at the time. And they had also the Westbury Hotel in New York, and they were building the Plaza Athénée Hotel. So I told Jean-Louis, I said, you know, I really want to go to New York. I don't know where to go to work. I don't know what to do. And he said, let me see. And he placed me at the Westbury Hotel. And I went to the Westbury following that.
Right. Well, it sounds like there was a very strong contingent of French chefs and compatriots here in D.C. when you first came.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the American sort of... I was going to the market in Georgetown, and Patrick O'Connell was there. coming with his... I don't know, he had this beat-up car. From the 60s, maybe. He had a car from the 60s, and it was, you know, like one of those... cruise ship car, like what do you call it? Like those big fat
Oldsmobiles?
Kind of like something like that. Where the trunk, you could put a ton of stuff in the trunk.
Or dead bodies.
Yeah, exactly. and he was coming to that market, and basically he was just this young American chef who was starting this unique place.
Patrick is now a 3-star Michelin chef at the Inn in Little Washington.
The first in the area.
You see, his commitment to excellence, his commitment to ingredient. I mean, he was coming to D.C. because at the time, I don't think his network of farmers and network of suppliers were really developed. And he had to drive, 4 times a week. I was coming to buy my little things there at the market and see him. So it's there was a beginning of amazing young American chef here. And then going to New York, of course, that kept growing.
Well, and we've talked about this on the show before, but like D.C. previously, I mean, like in 80, 81, like it was a commuter city. Like people would come here to work. Mm-hmm. you know, there wasn't the D.C. population has essentially doubled since then. And D.C. was kind of a food desert. There weren't, like, quality food markets. There weren't the restaurant scene isn't what it is today.
Yeah, that was a Safeway, I guess.
Yeah.
That was about the only food market. No, there were a couple of food markets, but then chefs got organized and really started to develop. I mean, Jean-Louis was the one who started to really develop a network of person who was, one was doing rabbit for him, one was doing squab, you know, retired lawyer who had a little farm in Virginia. Hey, why don't you make me squab? You're going to raise them like that way, and you're going to feed them that way, and you're going to...
Amazing.
Well, let's focus on D.C., and there's now a new renaissance of trying to revive Mid-Atlantic cooking and Mid-Atlantic cuisine, mm-hmm. and I know you were cooking, you know, strictly kind of French food back in D.C. Like, how... Were there any ingredients that you tried to incorporate into your cooking?
Of course.
That was very super local to
of
this
course.
Region?
I mean, first, I mean, we talk about soft shell crab because it's starting right now the season.
It is, yeah.
And soft shell crab was something I fell in love the first time I had it. And I'd never seen that in France. And so much that I decided to smuggle soft shell crab in France. So in the time... You could take anything in the plane. And so I will have a big cooler and I will have they put either hay or they put straw a little bit and wet straw and wet papers, mm-hmm. wet paper, layers of live soft shell papers, layers of soft shell. And I will bring 20 pounds of soft shell to my home in France. And I will arrive, I will leave Friday night, DC or New York, and I will arrive in Lyon Saturday at noon and open the box and start to cook soft shell for all my family.
How did you cook them?
And they
How
were
did you
live.
Choose to cook
oh,
them?
I mean, we had a big burner outside, on the you make a outside with a wood fire, kind of like mm-hmm. with a pan, big pan over. It was not a paella pan, but a pan like that, and we cooked them meuniere and. Actually, it's...
Sounds pretty good.
It's it hasn't changed much for that. And, so long... I mean, not so long, but, you know, even today, I'm cooking them the same way than I cooked them then. But soft shell crab was one of them, but there was also... I mean, the Chesapeake Bay was there, and people enjoyed going on weekends to the Chesapeake Bay and... Enjoyed those ingredients.
Did you also smuggle a little Old Bay seasoning in that suitcase?
Yeah.
from Old Bay to France.
That exactly. That don't exist in France.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to move there and open up a crab shack.
Just one seat.
Just on the Normandy coast.
Yeah.
Normandy.
serve one person.
Yeah, no, you should.
We should. Okay, great. That's Danielle's next restaurant.
And I'll be the bartender, you'll be the cook.
Okay.
Yeah.
Negronis and crabs.
Let's play a little game we like to do just to kind of get to know you.
Just like in the kitchen. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. Just to get to know you a little bit better. This is called Two Truths, One Lie.
Two Truths, One Lie.
So we've asked you to prepare a few statements.
His homework, yeah.
Yeah. One of which will be a complete and utter lie. And Eddie and I will try to guess which of the statements is the falsehood.
The falsehood is him smuggling seafood back into the country of breaking federal law. He did not do that.
We have a pretty strong history of not winning this game.
Right.
For the record, chef.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So no pressure.
So do you want me to tell you the truth?
Yeah.
You'll tell all three statements, and then we will guess which one is false.
Okay. I did receive the French Legion of Honor. That could be one.
Okay.
He's not making a lot of eye contact when he says these things.
You know, it's hard to tell where I'm born exactly, but I'm born near Paris.
Okay.
And
in a major surrounded by three kings.
Yeah. And I cooked for my first French president at the age of 15.
Oh, these are such French things.
I'm sensing a theme here.
Which president would that be?
Oh, it was not the goal. Too old. It was not Giscard d'Estaing. So maybe, I don't know. Maybe Pompidou?
Okay. I think that's a lie.
That's a lie.
Yeah, you didn't.
I want that one to be true because he started cooking at 14, and that would be quite the rise to fame.
Yeah, that's the lie, do you think?
That's a lie, yeah.
Yeah.
So you lost.
Oh, no.
Because first I was born near Lyon, not Paris. So okay. The other two are real.
Oh. Okay. He's born in his hometown, yes.
Yeah, no, I'll take you there. You'll see why.
All right. All right, well, tell us about cooking for the president.
So, yeah, that was Pompidou. And the restaurant I was working for, in Lyon, it was a 2-star restaurant, and we were doing a lot of catering outside, like, you know, party here, party there. And we would always do the city hall and the state hall because it was in the same city.
Yeah.
And the state hall was the prefecture de Lyon, prefecture du Rhône, I mean, the state of the Rhône. I was at the age of 14. I had to provide my birth certificate. I had to provide all kind of things. And they made me this official with a blue, white, red ribbon crossing to it and all that, an official pass to get into the building in order to be able to do the lunch for the president of France. And because, you know, I was 15, so what I was doing, I was carrying the box and helping my boss and all that. But, you know, I was included in that little group of chefs who had to go and cook for the president. So that was impressive. I mean, I kept the piece of paper still because it was kind of my first claim to fame moment as a cook.
When I was in college, I went to school here in D.C. My very first like cater waitering gig, I got to go to the White House, and it was during the Bush era, the W era, and it was some kind of dignitary, Indian dignitary thing. Either way, long story short, I basically dropped a whole tray of raspberry sauce all over somebody's tuxedo, and that was my
Well, I cooked at the Blair House across from the White House, and the time was Reagan, and I was invited to cook because that was the president of the European Economic Community. Who was invited as a guest, and he was staying at the Blair House, and they always do an official dinner there as a visiting president coming. That was my first foray into cooking for president in America.
That's amazing.
That was the first president I served, yeah, actually.
I'm guessing, I mean, you were up shoulders with all the giants, and you've cooked for everybody. Is there somebody that still kind of makes you, is there a celebrity out there or a fellow chef that makes you nervous to cook for at this point?
Not nervous, but proud. And, you know, last night I was in New York and we were celebrating the Jacques Pépin Foundation in New York. He has created a foundation who support underprivileged individuals who need to, you know, the reinsertion in life sometime or things where they really need a direction and a support and a wonderful foundation. And Jose Andres was there as well as a guest of honor, and maybe 30 other chefs. And Jacques, to me, is my biggest pride as a French chef because for what he has done, he has been cooking now for 70 years.
Unbelievable.
70 years. And can you imagine? For you bartending for 70 years?
I can barely imagine what I'm going
to
make tomorrow.
You don't have to shake the shakers for you, but... No, Jacques is amazing, and he's so funny and witty, and so there, what he did with his career, with what he did for every home in America to inspire people to cook, and I mean, with Julia,
one of the first celebrity chefs, essentially, right?
PBS,
very much,
right there.
And so to me, it's it don't make me nervous, but because I'm French and I know he knows his French food, when I cook for him, I don't want him to get lost with my creativity. So I try to stay a little bit more maybe to the point, and I feel I'm still staying French.
Yeah.
You know, no ginger, right. No lemongrass. So.
So that'd be Matthew. That'd be like you cooking a burger for, I don't know, who's the king of burgers
around
here? Don't
say Guy Fieri.
Guy Fieri.
No.
Different style, different personality.
I still get nervous cooking for my parents, so.
Of course.
I can never cook the right meal for my parents, I feel like. And it's my parents. They don't, you know.
But for me, when I cook for my parents, I basically try to imitate my mother, and she always get involved. And at the end, I can never cook them the meal
exactly
I want.
Yeah.
And because I want to make sure that it's home cooking, and I'm home in France with them. So I think you have to stick to your mother's cooking.
Yeah. I mean, do you cook a lot at home at all anymore? Is this a thing that you?
Yeah, because I mean, I have a daughter who lives in D.C. actually. She has been living here now for 4 years. And I have new children. And so I have a young boy with 5 and a young girl with 2. And so we took a house in the country, north of New York, 1 hour north. And I just redid the whole kitchen and all that. And I'm looking forward to cook on weekend, cook for friends.
But you're gonna be cooking for kids, so it's gonna be a lot of butter macaroni.
The kids are invited at the table, but the kitchen tables, the friends are invited at the dining table.
Oh.
So I'm looking forward to cook a lot. My wife also, she's a very good cook, and she cooks for the children every day, and is very, very well organized with that, and cook them amazing meal. And they eat everything, and then once in a while they say, oh, no green today. But cooking for children, I think you learn so much.
Yeah.
And for me, my family in France, by the time we gather everybody, we're about 55 or 60 people. So we like, you know, we know how to cook for an army.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, you, kind of from just what you're saying, your mom sounds like she was a good cook. You started cooking at a very young age.
And my grandmother as well.
Was your family kind of a driving force in this?
Yeah, no, plus, I mean, being born on the farm, everything we had on the table every day, breakfast, lunch, dinner, it was from the farm. So breakfast was a big slab of pork belly, you know, poached pork belly, like a cured pork belly. And eggs and bacon and red wine. And was breakfast.
I've been living life wrong.
No, because, you know, they get up at 5 o'clock.
That's what we call the keto diet these days.
You know, they get up at 5 o'clock to take care of the animals and things like that. And then by 7:30, you know, the kids get up, but they are really doing their first lunch. Kind of, it's the first lunch. It's not really breakfast at that point.
Right.
And they have to have breakfast of champion. And so there was this entire buffet on the table for breakfast. And as a kid, you grow up and clack, a little piece of cheese, a little piece of pork belly, a little piece of potatoes, eggs.
Now, what kind of farm was this? It was just kind of...
Everything.
Yeah.
So because we were a little bit on the hill, so we were doing grains. We were doing hay, a lot of hay, because we had 25 cows. We had about 40 goats. We had 3 pigs. So the pigs, they all end up in the larder. The 3 of them end up for the whole year supply in the larder for making ham and saucisson and all that. And then guinea hen. My father was doing the farmer's market in Lyon every week, every Saturday morning. And I was helping him because Saturday I didn't have school, so I will drive with him very early in the morning. And there will be, I don't know, 30 foot long, bank tables, all the vegetable you can imagine, seasonal vegetable, from, you know, squash in the winter and or squash in the summer and peas and haricot vert and eggplant and zucchini and onion, garlic, a lot of garlic we were doing, and then all the livestock, chicken, squab, rabbit, turkey at the turkey season, goose, duck, What else? They were there. Yeah, that was about it. And then the only thing we were not selling was the charcuterie, the saucisson, and the ham, because we kept it for ourselves.
Right.
It's just for family consumption. And then cheese, a lot of cheese, goat cheese. So the goat cheese was 80% goat cheese, goat milk during the summer, spring, summer, fall. And then 20% cow's milk. And then in the winter, it was falling into a 60% cow's milk, 40% goat milk, because the goats weren't going to graze as much. So they weren't producing as much milk. But we never stopped making cheese. So the cheese platter on the table, basically, it was 7 different cheese made of the same cheese at different stage, including having them rotting into like a 3-month-old cheese rotting into the must. The must, you know, when you make wine, have the must, and that's what you make eau de vie with. And once the eau de vie is made, then you put the cheese inside, you close the jar, and you let it rot like this. It was amazing.
That's cool. That sounds amazing.
I mean, you say all these things. It's like, how did you not become a chef? Do you have siblings at all?
Yeah, I have 2 brothers, 2 sisters.
Are they also involved in the food industry?
No.
No, okay.
No. But they are very good eater.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna take a quick break. We're gonna step out for a second. We're here with Chef Daniel Boulud, and when we come back, we're gonna dive a little bit deeper into his career. You're listening to Shift Trick.
All right, welcome back. You're listening to Shift Drink on Full Service Radio. On my right is Matthew Ramsey, and our left is acclaimed chef and restaurateur Daniel Balloud. During the break, earlier when we were prepping for the show, Matthew found one of your old books, of the many books that you've written. It's a cocktail book that you wrote.
Oh, yeah.
But I'm way more interested in what you're talking about during our break, which is some of the hooch that your family used to distill and create back on your farm. Like, in addition to all the charcuterie and all the cheeses and all the meats and game and fowl that you
we made our own booze, absolutely. And I was talking about vin de pêche, peach wine, yes. Where you have to pick up the peach leaves from the tree at a certain time and put that into a jar, and that goes with some eau de vie or grappa, and also some other wine. You can put some white wine, or I have to ask my mother's the recipe of the vin de pêche.
Please, we would love to have that recipe.
And so it balances into something like a Campari or like a vermouth. It becomes almost like a vermouth of peach.
Yeah.
Huh. It's a fortified wine. And we were doing also walnut wine, where you take the green walnut before they even form a shell. Mm. So it's really the nuts. But I don't know if you have those walnuts here. So, you know, as a kid, you have to basically go with a big stick and hit the tree, because the walnuts don't fall unless they're ripe. So you have to kind of get them down, and then you put that also, you pierce that, and you put that in a jar and create this...
Yeah,
walnut wine.
Here we call it like creme de, or wait, it's nocino, creme de noix, and nocino in Italian. Yeah. But that's usually done with spirit. But
yeah, so doing we put it in, spirit inside, okay. And but that become dark black. I mean, it oxidizes that thing inside and create that very funky color. It's almost like dark blue, dark green. And then we were doing, grappa. So the grappa is basically we were making our own wine in the farm. Mm-hmm. And we had two barrels, but then after, once you press the wine, you keep the must, and you the grape, the skin, and the raffle, what do you call it, the stem,
the stems and the leaves,
the stem,
and everything.
The leaves, the skin, not the leaves, stem and the skins and the seeds, and you let it ferment for about 4 months, and usually in January, that's when you do the grappa. And so in the old days, we used to make our own booze. And now we kept the machine. And once in a while, we do our pear grappa. We do our apricot grappa. We do all that. But we do also the basic grappa. And go to the village. The truck come.
And a traveling distillery that used to come.
Yeah, exactly. And then we dump our buckets or our barrels of fermented must. And you go home with the bottles of grappa. It produced quite a lot. And what we used to do is then we come also with about 10 pounds of sausage in a bucket.
Oh.
And we throw the sausage inside the grappa. And then we, with the shovel, we pick them up and put them in a bucket, cover it, and take it home.
Huh.
And then you go around the table and eat the sausage cooking the grappa we just made.
This is the original Jello shot, essentially.
Is it?
Yeah.
This is the original pickleback, maybe?
But then the freakish things we were doing with it, I had an uncle who loved to do that for the whole family and friends. So he will go in the springtime for viper in the forest and everywhere in the country.
So
we just went from sausage to live snakes.
And put the live snake in the bottle with the grappa and let that marinate for at least, you need at least 6 months to a year to kind of rest. And then
how does this get decided? How does it 6 months
it's
of
very,
actually, testing viper?
Well,
if you have an abundance of vipers in your forest.
I mean, if I soak you in alcohol, that's what,
DC, we might use our rats.
In the ancient days, that's how they were preserving.
I do give, for the record, permission for my body to be turned into alcohol after this. But
so you never had viper grappa?
I've never had viper grappa.
We heard stories about... In Southeast Asia, we have viper whiskey and random things like
when
that.
When we say viper, though, we're talking about specifically like snakes that are venomous?
Yeah, of course.
Because I mean, garden,
you don't take the venom snakes out. That's the idea.
And this is making me squirm.
You see
hard
in the bottle, then the snake has his mouth open, and you can see that venom out.
So if anyone's wondering, Chef Balut has a liver that is indestructible, and his whole family will live forever.
But I tell you, my parents are 91, and I don't think that snake grappa did any bad thing to them.
That's amazing.
It's not the shot you have every Sunday. I mean, you pull it out when you want
occasion
to impress your friends and family. Yeah.
And you were saying that the effect is kind of euphoric?
Oh, what is that?
Did you speak French? The effect of the viper.
Pleasurable.
No. No, it was not aphrodisiac, but it was hallucinogen, I will say. I don't know. Every time I took it, I felt like
there's
weird.
A twinkle in Matthew's eye.
It was kind of like...
I'm back.
It's like you're drinking something who is a little too surreal and push you a little bit on the edge. My father said that this was the best medicine when you had any pain anywhere or anything. That was the best medicine to drink, the snake, the
rabbit. Or to just like pour on an open wound, I feel like.
to disinfect all of your tools. I mean, going into your career and how creative you've been, and Matthew really wanted to touch on this, is, I mean, you're doing crazy shit when you're growing up with your family, and you're doing kind of crazy stuff in the kitchen and in your Michelin-starred restaurants. Like, did it translate well?
Yeah, but it translates to something people enjoy. If I start to bring the crazy stuff we were doing in the farm, because I think we grew up with it, their parents and grandparents were doing that. There were a lot of traditional things, and I think... that stay with me, but it's not always translating into the creativity of what we do. And I think, for example, at Danielle, and also in America, being in America now for more than 3 decades, I have chefs from all over the world working with me. And I think that I'm maybe the only French chef in America who, for the first 10 years of my tenure as a chef, I had a Cambodian chef de cuisine. And the second 10 years after that, for 20 years, the second tenure had an American Chinese, Alex Lee, so Sota Kun for 10 years, and Alex Lee in New York, who was my chef de cuisine. And
your executive chef at DBG, right, DBGB right now is from Singapore.
Exactly. Nick Tang is from Singapore. So there is always, for me, this comfort of being out of my comfort zone with chef and try to steer them into the French and let them pull me into their mind also.
Ah, so you've inserted a foil into your...
Yeah, but it's not that I want to cook what they do or where they're from, but I definitely have the gate open to creativity with that. And at Danielle or at a Café Boulou, for example, the chef is American. The chefs there have always been Italian-American, Andrew Carmelini or Gavin Kaysen, who is American from the West Coast, and then Minnesota, pardon, and then Aaron Bloudon now. And they are proud to be able to cook French. But then some of the restaurants I have, like at Café Boulou, we have a menu voyage. And the menu voyage is all the cuisine but the French cuisine. And right now we have Vietnamese cuisine. So we do the shrimp toast, we do on papaya salads and things. We always had, last month we had New Orleans cuisine. The before that we had Mexican cuisine. And we really go into our inspiration come directly from tradition, not from a mismatch of things. And we refine tradition, just like I do in French cuisine, we do the same in those cuisines.
I mean, you mentioned Vietnamese and New Orleans, and those are from French traditions. But then the third one was Mexican, which yeah, I can imagine is very
there
difficult to
no,
kind of fit into.
There's enough amazing Mexican cook to help you, guide you. Like, when I do a pozole, I'm not pretending to give the recipe to my chef. I want my chef to give me the recipe and I tune it up.
How often do you get to roll up your own sleeves and kind of work on personal projects and
well, maybe you should endeavors. Come tonight and
yeah,
follow me.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, if you're gonna be behind the kitchen, we were.
there's always opportunity to do special project, either creating a new book or having some R&D development with my chef. Or I mean, I understand, and you know, I was brought up as a fine dining chef and a fine dining French chef, kind of. I never really worked in a bistro or in a brasserie as a young chef. I always work in the 2 and 3 star, but I enjoy making simple casual food. That's why DBGBDC, it's for me, what does DBGB stand for? Well, yes, there was a club called CBGB in New York, but it's to me Daniel Boulud Great Bistro, Daniel Boulud Great Brasserie. But
not Daniel Boulud Grass
blues. Bluegrass Country.
Yeah, anything you
we looked that up.
You know, when I opened DBGB the first time, we asked Food and Wine. Food and Wine asked all their listeners or readers to give us a version of their DBGB. And we had the most hilarious version of the translation of DBGB. So that was fun. But Épicerie Boulud, I mean, in New York, you can have Daniel Boulud for $300 at Daniel, or you can have it for $15 at Épicerie Boulud with the amazing jambon beurre, where we make the bread, we make the ham, and we, of course, select the butter carefully and do everything in the house.
Is butter the foundation of everything?
No, but butter is healthy as long as your health is good.
Butter. Yeah. I have eggs written down in my notes right now because I think...
I have an egg every day.
Egg every day. How do you prefer... Favorite way to prepare your egg?
That's my wife who cooked the eggs. Mm-hmm. And on Sunday is the, you know, the toast with a hole.
Toad in a hole, yeah.
Toad in a hole.
Egg in a basket is what I call it.
Oh, yeah.
Something in the devil, I don't know. There's a million names for it.
So on Sunday with the brioche, homemade brioche, we have, she does that because my kid loves that on Sunday. So that's the egg on Sunday. And every day it's 4.5 minute, less, 4 minute eggs. Yeah, 4.5 minute eggs.
You may have answered my question because the ultimate test is what, for chefs is an egg. And all week, I'm going to tell you, all week I've been eating omelets because I've been on an omelet kick. Is that still the ultimate test in your eyes?
Omelet, of
course.
For
a chef? The omelet or even the egg?
The hardest thing for a cook, for a chef, is to be able to cook eggs consistently and to master perfection while cooking an egg. Because you cook an egg in the rush. You cook an egg in a very practical way, and you often do it nicely, you do it right, but to cook it perfect, it's very hard. Like, for example, I remember as an apprentice, you have to learn all your classics and you have an exam, and one of them is a fry eggs. And a fry eggs, it's basically you have maybe 3 tablespoons of oil in a pan, and you put the eggs and you have to baste. You have to baste the eggs so the eggs kind of like fry but fluff under the hot spoon of oil. But you have a chance to burn yourself to do that. But if you don't fry it properly and it get that perfectly like pale coloration, because you don't want to overcook the white and yet you want the yolk to run and the whole eggs to be kind of like the yolk to be encased in this sort of shell of beautiful white fried white eggs, and it's hard.
Yeah,
it's hard.
It's so not just French.
Eggs in the, it's not just eggs in the oil, and then you will have that French teacher with certainly an attitude those days. Will look at your eggs and just destroy you. You know, if the eggs was not right.
I've been there.
You've been there. I don't even dare to do it at home because I know I'm going to burn myself. Do you expect people to?
Maybe if you do it in a wok, I think you're going to be okay. If you do it in a wok, there's enough borders to catch the oil.
Well, let's cut to our final section. This is going to be a series of questions we call Rapid Fire.
Time for the payback.
Rapid Fire.
So, Chef, these are going to be just kind of a quick series of questions. You're going to just kind of answer tip of the tongue, whatever comes to your mind first. Most influential cookbook in your collection?
Huh. Urbain Dubois. 18...
Nobody has this in their library.
Something.
I'm guessing this is first edition.
Falling apart. Favorite pair of shoes?
Few volume.
Your favorite pair of shoes to wear in the kitchen?
Right now it's a Bali leather and what is that? Running shoes.
Those are super fly. Yeah.
Yeah. And, French, Swiss pair of shoes. Bali.
What was maybe like the most like? I'm gonna ask you to describe this in graphic detail. Like the worst, maybe like. Cook or worst cut you've had in the kitchen,
or like the worst cut,
like worst injury in the kitchen.
Yeah. So I was 16, and at the time I was on my phase of apprenticeship, where you move from station to station, and I was working in the butcher block.
Oh.
And
I'm already cringing.
I was working in a butcher block, and I was doing all kind of things. And there was a calf liver to be sliced, and I was cleaning sweetbreads, and there were some other things on the butcher block. And the knife slipped and went right through my shoes.
Oh.
And it stayed down like this. The knife stayed right between my my ankle and my toes.
Oh.
Right straight down like this.
And it was just stuck in there.
The butcher knife, short blade, short blade, but heavy kind of like handle.
Oh.
And it got stuck there. So I removed it and I had to run to the hospital. And
Daniel's PR people stitches. Are sitting on the couch right now and they're cringing. It's warming a little
so,
bit.
So you see, it's very important to wear shoes that cover well
that's
your
right,
feet.
That's right. This is a leading question. Yeah.
Or have very dull knives. Make
these,
sure
these
never
shoes actually come with extra toes.
Oh, good.
Why? Because the butcher block was beat up. Because, you know, when you work on a butcher block, it looked like a hill and valleys. When, you know, you basically cut things at the same place. And then every day you rub that butcher block.
Yeah.
And you own it every day. So the butcher block is like this. And the knife slipped into it and boom.
Chef, do you own a microwave?
No, my wife. Oh. But we never do anything.
Well, the question was the last food item you ate that was microwaved.
Popcorn.
Okay. Okay.
What was your first concert?
That was, what's her name? Tina Turner and Ike.
Yes.
Ike and Tina Turner in Lyon.
Wow.
And that was, I remember it was... It was not the Olympia in Lyon. He had a name, that theater. And it was still a small theater. And I was, 14 and a half, 15. And I was living by myself in Lyon.
So I was
going to all those concerts. And to me, that concert was just mesmerizing.
This is Matthew's question. I'm going to steal it.
So we're talking 1970.
Yep. Oh, my God. That's amazing.
I can see that shoulder.
If you spent any time in a hot tub, where are two historical figures you would like to spend time in a hot tub with?
Well, actually, one passed. I think I will like to do it with Tony Bourdain because he was such a storyteller. And he was such a wealth of... A wealth of knowledge, but also, inner connection with chef. And the second, I did it in Japan, in an island called Sado Island with Nobu.
Ah.
And that was the most hilarious time I ever had it was not even a hot tub. It was a hot spring where we went into one of those soaking springs in Japan, you know, where they steam all over. And
is that okay, Matthew?
Yeah.
To be in a hot spring versus a weird, creepy hot tub?
We'll let it slide.
I don't know, but I mostly hang out in the hot tub with men.
Sounds like good company.
We should go to Spa World out in Centerville later today, then.
Oh, no, we can't. There was another article recently published.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Spa World has been getting a little flack lately. Anyways,
every year,
Korean style hot springs.
Oh yeah, really? Huh? Yeah.
Every year, there's a new article that comes out that tells you exactly why you should not go to Spa World. And ours.
I've never been, recently. But if you want to take me there,
but up in New York,
do you do karaoke in the hot tub?
Oh,
we don't need music. What are you saying? What are you saying for karaoke?
Oh, French song, Johnny Hallyday or Charles Aznavour.
Okay, I'm gonna bone up on my.
I stick to my French. Karaoke.
Yeah. All right, final question. What is your deathbed meal? Your last supper.
Well, I hope I can enjoy it. I think it'll be back home, and you know, with my father's bread, my mother roast chicken, my garden potatoes there, and all the vegetables, and my family. I think I want a big meal. I want you know, the last supper. All the way back home.
Finish it with a big glass of Viper whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. to let you go out in style.
Oh, yes, on your own terms.
That's actually what causes it. Well, Chef, thank you so much for joining us this
week. Thanks a lot. Yeah, super entertaining.
If anyone's listening to right now, you have an event tonight at ZBGB celebrating the Cherry Blossom Festival.
Fortunately, we are fully booked. So if anyone wanted to come, I think they can have the menu of that Cherry Blossom Festival celebration. Mm-hmm. They can have the menu following the desk. But see you all in ZBGB DC or New York City.
Awesome. Great. Awesome. Yeah. And for those of you listening, you can revisit this week's episode or previous episodes on iTunes or wherever you grab your podcasts, like the Spotify. Also, you can find us on all the social medias as @ShiftDrinkDC.
Don't forget to throw us a review on iTunes or give us a 1-star review on Yelp.
Give you a 5-star.
No.
We only want 1-star reviews.
Oh, it's only 1-star.
Only 1-star, Chef.
Cafe Balloon and Danielle can get 5-stars reviews. We want the 1-star review.
Well, I'll give you 5-star for the Negroni. Yeah.
You just made my week. Thank you.
Until next week, friends.
All right.
You're listening to Shift Drink.
Thanks, Chef.